Hello and welcome to Scriptlock, an informal chat about writing and storytelling in video games. I'm your host, Nick Folkman.
And I'm Max Folkman. We are here with Brian Kindergan, who is a writer, a storied writer of currently at Blizzard and
formerly of BioWare.
And a very accomplished storyboard artist.
Oh.
Or so I've seen.
Oh. Hello.
Hello. And we have Deandra Lazzarato.
Yes.
Yes. Who is an editor currently at Carbine Studios on WildStar.
Yep.
And previously of BioWare and Riot and a couple other places.
Yes.
So one of the first things that Nick and I noticed looking at Brian's resume was you worked on Boogerman.
Oh, wow.
Talk to us about that.
That you neglected to mention in past interviews.
That's wow. True. That's true. Boogerman does not come up very often. But when I was first getting into the animation industry, I was looking for work as a storyboard artist, but it was hard to find that work right out of the gate. And one job that I found in the first few years of trying to get in was as an assistant animator on this game. It was being made out of a house in the valley. Yeah, I mean it's as sketchy as it sounds. I was hired to do cleanup. They were doing traditional animation in a video game. And so I started doing cleanup, but I was really terrible at cleanup. But I was much better at in-betweening and assistant animating. Basically, if you're bad at your job, sometimes you get promoted. It's a great strategy. But so they had me do assistant animation on that. And it was really fun. It was a good time. At that time, I was playing a lot of games, but that wasn't like my career trajectory. I want to be in films. I want to see my name in lights. Not really. I wasn't motivated by that. But I wanted to work in film doing, long form storytelling.
So
was that game important to you? Did you grow up playing it? Or?
We remember seeing it and that, like along with Earthworm Jim and
those weird those similar platforms are all animation heavy like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I animated the scene where he sniffs his own armpit.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. So that's enough Boogerman. But to go transition into talking about how you started, how you got into video games for both of you.
Ooh.
Do you want me to go first?
Yeah, I'll let you go first.
Okay. So for me, I was working as a storyboard artist and generally having a good time doing that. I was teaching storyboards at CalArts as well. But I sort of started to get burned out. That was actually one of the reasons I had started teaching as well, to kind of like rekindle that love of storyboarding. But I was kind of burned out on the process, and it was sort of at that time storyboarding was becoming less about storytelling and more about drawing. And I love drawing, but the main reason I was a storyboard artist was to deal with storytelling. So at the same time, I was playing a lot of video games. I mean, I had been for years, but I was, I think I was playing Baldur's Gate 2, and I noticed that BioWare was looking for a writer, just kind of stumbled across it on the internet.
That newfangled internet thing.
Yeah, and I was like, if people write video games, like, they actually do that? Obviously I was playing games that had writing and dialogue in them, but I just didn't.
Is that when you realized that there were writers in video games?
That it's a thing, yeah. Yeah, I was kind of stunned. So at that time, BioWare would only accept an application for a writing job by having you send in a Neverwinter Nights mod, which was scary to me because I was like a storyboard artist, pencil, paper, I didn't even really know what a mod was. And because I was an artist, I owned Mac, everything Mac, right? And so I was like, I guess I'm switching to PC because Neverwinter hadn't come out on Apple. I think it did later, but anyway. Yeah, I went out and I bought a PC and a copy of Neverwinter, and I made a mod, which included having to do scripting and all that stuff. And I sent it up to BioWare. And then they lost it. So I didn't hear from them for quite a while. And having worked in Hollywood, I was used to that. That means means rejection, right? Mm-hmm. But I did poke them a few months later, and they're like, "Oh no, we never got a mod from you." So I resent it, And then they seemed to like it, so they hired me to come up to Edmonton and work on Jade Empire.
That was the first time you made a mod?
Yeah. Yeah. I had no idea. But I was, in a way, it was amazing because I got Neverwinter, and it's like, oh, the tool set is here. I'm like, what's a tool set? You know, and I opened it, and then it was one of those things where over the course of a couple weeks, I started going, oh, my God, they gave us everything that they used to make the game, right? And so I was like building levels and adding NPCs and then writing conversations for them. And then I did so much unnecessary scripting in my mod. Like my mod was, you know, you're supposed to be able to play it in like 10 minutes. And mine was like an hour playthrough, you know. But when I sent it up to them, I said like, oh, it's if you just do the critical path, it's 10 minutes, which wasn't really true, but it seemed to work. But that all of that was just born of that I'm not an overachiever by nature. But it was just born of being like, oh my God, and I can have this guy. Every time you get close to him, he runs away. I can write a script to do that. That's amazing. You know, it's not really amazing, but.
But so you sent that in, and after they actually got that mod, did the interview process continue?
Yeah, they emailed me and they said they wanted to do a phone interview. James Olin, who was the lead designer of the Baldur's Gate games and has gone on to do many other great things since, he called me and we spoke for a bit. It was a really strange coincidence that among all of the science fiction and fantasy authors that I love, I just almost randomly chose Jack Vance to say, we were talking and I'm like, I really like Jack Vance, he's great. And I later found out that Ray and Greg, the two guys who started BioWare, are huge Jack Vance fans. And so all the designers, including James, were likewise Jack Vance fans. So it was just this bizarre coincidence. But yeah, that interview seemed to go well. Then they flew me up for an in-person interview. And again, I don't know if they still do this or not, but they spent the morning interviewing me, and then they stuck me in an office in the afternoon with a computer and a copy of Neverwinter and said, make a quick mod, just a quick one, just make it.
And so, how long did the previous mod take you to make?
Oh, like 4 months.
Okay.
But I was, you know, I mean, I was working, and yeah, it was just sort of in the evenings. But yeah, so I made a quick and dirty little mod, and, you know, they seemed to like that. So they offered me a job, you know, like a week or two after I went back to LA. And that was, you know, my first confrontation with, you know, wages and pay scales in games versus film.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm making mysterious motions with my hands. So, but, you know, it was like, okay, if I want to make this change, if I cannot bear the idea of doing another storyboard, you know, this year, then I'll just take the hit. So,
how big were they back then, BioWare?
I think I was probably about the 103rd employee or something like that.
And that was still at one studio, one game studio?
One, oh, yeah, yeah. They worked on...
This is pre-Austin, I think.
This is well before Austin, yeah. Yeah. So they were... It was about 100 people, and they were in a really kind of dumpy old building located over a bookstore, which was cool, but... while I was there, they actually moved down the road to a bigger building that they're still in, or one branch of BioWare is in. But yeah, so it was you know, 100 people is a big studio, but it kind of felt small and homey. It was a lot of like local folk working there, you know, so it was nice.
And how many writers did they have?
At that time, I want to say, maybe around 6 or 7. So they were a one game studio, except that just when I got hired, they were actually starting to develop. They were finishing Knights of the Old Republic, starting up Jade Empire, and starting up Dragon Age. And I was supposed to be hired for Dragon Age. That's in 2003. And basically on my first day, the lead designer of Jade Empire was like, hey, I need the new writer. I need him. You know, I'm like short of writers, and Knights of the Old Republic didn't give me the writers they're supposed to give me. So I sort of, you know, was going down a hallway and I took a right turn and then I was on Jade Empire.
And that was still pre-production?
Yeah, yeah. It was just starting up.
Mm-hmm. And I have one last question before we get to Deandra and how she got in. So before you got to BioWare, had you done any writing beforehand, or was just your storytelling was through storyboards?
I had done writing. While storyboarding, you write dialogue and stuff, or at least back then you did. So I was pretty experienced with writing dialogue, and then I just had done a lot of writing on my own at home. You know, my great treasured novel that I used to go home and work on. Which I eventually finished, and then it was on a hard drive that got stolen, and so goodbye, novel.
Maybe for the best.
probably, yeah. So, but yeah, that was about the extent of my writing.
All right, we'll get to Jade Empire and everything afterward next. But Deandra, how did you get in?
Oh, so the second time that Brian went up, what he's missing is Hollywood did suck him back in, and he came back for a little bit. But then he did go back to BioWare, and I was with him that time. And while we were up there, they needed an editor for one of their unannounced projects. So they specifically needed somebody with good data organizational skills, and my background comes from library. I do not have my master's, but there is a program in Canada that's Library Science and Information Technology, and that was the thing that I took in college there, and obviously gave me some great data organizational skills. So I applied for the job. I wasn't really thinking anything of it, but they got back to me. They're like, okay, like, your resume seems pretty legit. Here, do this test for us. So I did one test for them. They really liked it, so they sent me another test, and so I did.
What were the tests?
Well, the first one was a pure, like, grammar pass. Like, correct all these sentences. Like, let's see if you know what you're talking about in terms of, like, sentence structure and punctuation and, you know, how to use a semicolon and really basic stuff like that. The next pass they gave me was more for editing dialogue. So it was a lot, you know, how do these sentences sound? How will this translate over when you do voiceover work? You know, if the actor has to say this, does this logically flow here? They kind of gave me a branching conversation to try and follow the logic. So I did that one. And I also did a third test that I'm trying to recall, because I know there was one extra test on top of that actually they had just started giving out. So I was a guinea pig for that one. And that was, again, more along the lines of, like, the VO editing and everything. So I apparently did quite well on all of them, because they called me in for an in-person interview. And it was the first time that I've ever had, like, a panel interview. So I walk in the door, and there's 9 people staring at me, including, like, the design director and the project director of the project that I was being interviewed for, and all the editors, and I think there was, like, a couple of writers there, too, and I'm like, oh, hey, I've never done this before, so we'll go with it, you know? It was I just kind of, you know, relaxed my way into it, kind of kept it cool, just very conversational.
Apparently one of her interviewers was quite hot. Too.
Oh,
that's the first thing she told me.
No, they might be listening, so you just...
I didn't name names.
Yeah, we could all... Everybody at BioWare is going to laugh, because they're going to be like, who would have been... Oh, I know who. I know who, yes. One of them was quite attractive, so it was just a little bit like, I'm going to not, you know, print my hair and smile at those pretty, pretty eyes, but... that entire interview went really well, and they...
What was the interview like?
It was just a lot of, I guess they looked over my tests, and for certain parts of it, they questioned, like, why did I edit things a certain way? Like, why did I go this direction instead of this direction? You know, what's my logic? Kind of defend your stance, you know. What would you do in this situation? Like, say you encounter a difficult person, like, how would you deal with that? Or, you know, you think you're right, and the writer thinks they're right, and how do you resolve that so that everybody is happy? Because that's a lot with editing, too.
Yeah, those are great questions.
And then just, of course, you know, have you played BioWare games, you know?
Had you?
I had played... I think I played a little bit of Jade Empire at that point. Most of my experience was actually in MMOs before that.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. I played a lot of City of Heroes. Which also very popular at BioWare. There was one of the writers won a costume contest and had like a special in-game costume for the one that he built outside a game. He cosplayed his own City of Heroes character, and they gave him a special title and everything in-game. So when he's flying around, you're like, I know who you are. I actually found him on my server, and I was like, you know Brian Kindrigan. And he's like, who is this random person, stalker? Oh, my God. I'm like, no, it's cool. We're dating. He told me about you. He's like, oh, okay. I got this. But yeah, they Bioware gave me a call back. They thought I did great, and I started on the unannounced project. I was a contract worker there, so I only did it for about 9 months. Unfortunately, I was supposed to be hired at the end of that, but EA had laid off about 11% of their workforce. So, and Bioware was mostly untouched by that, but they actually could not renew contracts past that because they're like, EA let go of a lot of people, so
yeah.
This would be hard. And I'm totally cool. Totally cool. It was very shortly after that that we came to California, and that was all awesome and good.
Were editors a thing back then? Because even now, until like I was looking up, there was like a Polygon article about editors in games. Like I didn't know they existed because that stuff that I would think that would be editing is just stuff that would be handled by like either writers or just other
producers or producers, designers,
stuff like that.
BioWare has always been a big proponent of having editors because they are such a writing-driven studio that they understand that the job of a writer and the job of an editor are two very completely different things.
Could you define what an editor is for some people who they might not even have the right idea for what an editor does in games?
It's almost a little bit hard because it depends on like studio to studio what an editor does. Like at BioWare, definitely the editor assigned to the project will look through all the writing. Like they will look through and make sure that, you know, all your conversations play out logically, you know, the characters are true to who they are. Again, all the spelling, grammar, punctuation. They'll make style guides and pronunciation guides for, say, the VO actors so that when you have weird made-up words, everybody knows how to pronounce them, you know. They in a way, they keep a lot of the IP with them. They're the IP keepers.
Yeah.
And again, it changes from studio to studio. Like, there's a little bit of that on WildStar, too. Like, we touch almost all the writing in the game. I have another editor that works with me, Sean. He's also super awesome. Not to imply that I'm super awesome, I'm just saying that he's super awesome. But, yeah, we touch about just about every string that's ever made in the game, so.
Is two editors on a game about the average?
We started out with 5, actually.
On WildStar?
On WildStar, yeah. Way back in the day, we had 5. And then a couple of them trickled away. One got turned into a writer, and then the other trickled away as well. And so it was just down to 2. Like, before the game was launched, there's just such a vast amount of work that had to be done that you kind of needed a few more there to get all that work done. But once the game's launched, you know, 2 is probably, it can be hectic at times, but it's a good amount.
Is editing an MMO and like hugely different from other games, or is it just a matter of like scale, where it's just so much more content you have to deal with?
It's a little bit to do with scale, yeah. It can be different. Again, a story-driven game like a BioWare game is going to be very different to edit than say something that has smaller chunks of story. Like you can apply the same principles to both. Again, one's just on a smaller scale, and one's on a larger scale. But I think for, say, a BioWare game, you have to have a better idea of the bigger picture of things, as opposed to, say, in an MMO where, like, all the tiny little stories are more self-contained. There might be a giant overarching story, you know, told within, you know, dungeons and adventures and all that kind of thing, but it's a lot more, like, tiny little pieces, snippets that are easier to digest and wrap your head around.
I feel like one of the things specifically about MMOs for editors is that you have strings being entered in the game by many, many more people. You know, like on a BioWare game, you've got writers who will write, you know, the vast majority of the game, and then a couple of designers who might enter, you know, tooltips or something like that. But on an MMO,
they come from everywhere.
You've got like combat designers entering spell names, and then tooltips are written by who knows who. You know, there's just like stuff coming into the game from all angles, and that's where an editor really.
Yeah, like the class designers for all the different classes in the game, they'll handle the spells and the tooltips for those. So those are all writing. That's one of my specific things that I do. I do a lot of the spells, items with flavor text, or just even item names. Those come through us. UI text. So when you're waiting at the loading screen, those little tips pop up at the bottom.
Oh yeah.
That all gets passed through us. Different UI elements. So when you're looking, you know, you pop up a menu and you see all the writing on there. That all gets passed through us. Like a lot of the really boring, mundane stuff that people just don't tend to notice. That's still writing, and that still all gets passed through us. Fun stuff is the stories.
What don't you look at?
There is nothing we don't. Like, occasionally, there was one thing that we didn't look at recently, and that seemed to be an error message, and I know that there was a message on the board about it because it was just a very funny spelling error. But that was one that we didn't look at. But that's, again, handled, I think, on not our side. That's more a client side thing. So, but almost nothing. If it's writing and if it's a string, we quite literally trawl through the entire game to find anything that we haven't looked at and look at it.
Picking up where we left off with Brian. So
back to you.
You went back to Hollywood after your first stint at BioWare.
Yeah, I got sucked back down by an offer to direct a CG TV show for PBS. So I came down and did 2 seasons of that, but I sort of, you know, I shortly after I got back down here, I was like, oh wait, I just left this industry. What did I do? And so I sort of regretted the decision pretty quick. But I stuck around, you know, after the show, I stuck around and did boards, you know, on other stuff and worked at a couple different places. But then at a certain point, one of the writers I had worked with just a little bit on Jade Empire, actually, Drew Karpyshyn, you know, he and I had stayed in touch. This is before the days of Facebook, so I don't know how I stayed in touch because I'm really not good at that.
No, this was around Facebook time. Because this is around the time I went to Israel.
That's right, so this was Facebook. 2008. Okay.
Yeah. That was Facebook.
So, but I don't think it was over Facebook.
No,
anyway,
he emailed you.
Somehow,
because he didn't have a Facebook.
Somehow,
MySpace.
We communicated. Yes. Yeah, MySpace. AOL. And then he said, you know, hey, we're working on this this Mass Effect 2 thing, you know, and we need some more writers. Do you want to come up, you know, or do you want to apply? So I, at that time, we didn't really have an Xbox, so I hadn't played Mass Effect 1. It had just come out very only a few weeks earlier, but so we borrowed a friend's Xbox.
And his copy of Mass Effect 1.
And his copy of Mass Effect. BioWare didn't get my money. And so I played the game, and I was like, hey, this is really good. Yeah, I want to work on 2. So they wanted me to actually do another mod just because some high-level people had changed while I was away, or I don't know what happened. But I did another mod, much less ambitious, but, you know, kind of hopefully fun, and sent that up. And
you had to make another mod for this?
Yeah, even though the lead writer wanted me to come work for him, but...
So then did you make another one when you went up to the office again, like on the spot, make another mod?
No, they didn't do that the second time around. Okay. Actually, the interview the second time around was really kind of a formality. That was like, you know, I sent the mod up. I think that's where having the lead writer already wanting you, you know, pays off, because I went into the room and, I mean, it was like we just chatted. There was like 5 or 6 people there, but we kind of chatted, and they're like, what's your favorite movie? And, you know, like,
what'd
no,
you say?
Nothing. Star Wars, A New Hope, okay. Of course.
Not Shawshank.
Episode 4, A New Hope. No, Shawshank's up there. But then we talked about science fiction movies, and I was talking about stuff like Silent Running, and I don't know, that someone in the room seemed to really like that.
You got a great planet question, too.
Yes, and then one writer...
What your favorite planet is?
No, although that would have been a great question, because I would have trolled him and said Pluto. Is it a planet?
Would that have worked back then? Was it not a planet back then?
I don't know.
I don't think it was a planet then.
It hasn't decided what it wanted.
It's still a bit of a funny answer.
Yeah. Yes.
No, it was a science question. The most science fiction-y of the writers wanted to see if I had any grounding in science, which I absolutely don't. So he said, like, you know, okay, well, you're on a planet and... you know, it has the same gravity as Earth, but it's half the size, and something, something, and what color is the sky? So I walked through my thinking. I said, you know, like, well, okay, so it must be more dense than Earth if it's got the same gravity and it's half the size. Like, I sounded like I knew science, right? And then I reached the limit of what I could BS, and then I just pointed at him and I yelled, chartreuse! which made everybody laugh except him. But he wasn't offended or anything, but he was just like, oh, you so don't know what you're talking about.
Almost.
Yeah.
You sounded good up until that point.
Yeah. Apparently the answer was orange.
Hmm. Really? So. It wasn't green?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
You just definitely ruined, like, all the rest of the interviews now.
It was definitely not chartreuse, I can say that.
What color is chartreuse?
I don't even know.
Chartreuse is a greeny color.
Is it like greenish?
A yellowy, greeny color, I do believe.
Wouldn't that have been amazing if that was the right answer?
I was like, damn it, I can't fool this guy.
Also, before we move on, what was the mod you made?
The first one?
No, the second one.
The second one was you're in a city.
It was Neverwinter Nights again?
Oh, yeah, it was Neverwinter Nights. And the premise was you're trapped in a city that's under siege. It's going to be under siege soon. There's a giant army coming. Everyone there knows they're going to die. But the mayor or the lord of the city or whatever has locked down the city. Like, no one can leave. And so it's the rats on a sinking ship thing. Like, everyone that you talk to is trying to figure out how to get out of the city, you know? And so are you, you know? Yeah. And so you're trying to figure out a way to bribe, blackmail, kill, whatever you got to do to get out of the city.
Not very sci-fi.
Well, it was, you know, it was Neverwinter, so.
Yeah.
It's what I had available to me.
They have a prompt for the mod, just like, make whatever, or?
Yep. Their requirements, and this might be out of date, but they basically said, just make a game story, should be playable in 10 minutes, and make sure that the first NPC that we meet is memorable. Hmm. Which I think I was going on about that in my blog.
Yeah, how, like, I remember that.
A very simple instruction, and yeah, people would mess it up. So. Mm-hmm.
So what happened after you got hired? And how far along was Mass Effect 2 at that point?
It was in the very early stages. Okay. I started, and we, you know, I think like the first week we said, okay, we've got some, the core idea of what the game was going to be was already there, that it's, you know, build your squad and go on a suicide mission. Spoilers. So, you know, we had this ideas for the followers. They were just templates, right? We had the Mystic Warrior, right? That's all we knew about her, is that her name was the Mystic Warrior. We had the Convict. That's all we knew, was that she was a convict. And so the writers kind of divvied up the characters, and actually it was a terrible process. They literally went around the room like, oh, who do you want? And then I was like the last one, so I I didn't get any of the ones I'd originally wanted.
Who did you want?
I'm trying to think how to say it. I feel like I dodged a bullet. I wanted the femme fatale character. All I knew was that she was a femme fatale, and that sounded kind of cool. But that she ended up being Miranda, who I, you know, is probably not a character I would have enjoyed writing. So, the other character I wanted was the convict, but I didn't get her. But the guy, interestingly enough, the science fiction-y guy, got her. And then he actually came up to me the next day and he said, you know, I was thinking about that at home, and that kind of sucked that, like, basically you didn't get to pick anything. So, you know, do you want one of my characters? Like, we can trade. And I don't remember actually who I had, but I was like, yes, give me the convict, please.
No, not Thane, because that wouldn't have been him at that point.
Yeah, I don't know.
Legion?
No, he kept Legion.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know why. I don't think I have to use code. The guy's name is Chris Latoile. Yes. He's a great writer. He's a good guy. We actually shared an office on Mass Effect 2 for most of the run of that game. So, Chris definitely was not going to give up Legion.
No,
he really wanted Legion.
As he should not have.
Yes. Exactly. No, he did a great job with that character.
He did an amazing job on Legion.
If we had worked on that game, we would have killed everybody to get Thane. Right there. But half of that is his voice actor is insanely good.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know if that guy, like, does he have a throat problem? Like, that he sounds like that?
Oh, no, that was a process.
Okay.
It was a really interesting process.
Mm-hmm. And so good.
And I'm trying to remember if that actor, one of the Mass Effect 2 actors, I think it was him, like, drunk dialed, like, some kind of...
No, that was Legion's...
That was Legion's voice actor. Yeah. That's right. Good call. Yeah, drunk dialed some kind of, like, you know, conservative Christian foundation or something, and, like, left a message for them. And
as the character?
No, thank goodness, because then EA would have been very upset. But it was just an interesting story, yeah. And then he made a PSA, like, called Don't Drunk Dial. Are you hearing static? Mm-hmm. Oh, it's your phone.
I was trying to look up the actors, that's why.
Put in the show notes. How many writers were on Mass Effect 2?
So for most of Mass Effect 2, it was myself, Chris Latoile, Mac Walters, and Drew Karpyshyn.
Was
four of us for a big chunk of it. And then at a certain point, Patrick Weeks came on board from another project. And then towards the very end, there was Chris Hepler and like a number of other people sort of came on to help, you know, the end of the birthing process, get it through the canal.
What was, like, did they have, like, a writer's room? Like, what... we have no idea what the process is at, like, big companies about running games like that.
No, we were divided up in offices. So Drew and Mac were in an office with Karen Weeks, who was the editor. And then Chris and I were in an office. And then when Patrick joined us, he moved into our office. So we were all sort of separated, but we did a lot of peer review. So there was definitely a lot of writer interaction. You know, but yeah, it was more just of a peer review sort of process, and obviously we had our editor editing us, so.
Just a lot of, like, divvying up, like, specific sections of the game to do, or were they?
Yeah. So we wrote, basically, if you took over a character, you wrote the acquisition mission and the loyalty mission for them. So like, you know, I wrote out Jack's, the mission where you go to the ship to pick up Jack, and then the mission where Jack plants the bomb in her, in the facility where she grew up. And then the crit path missions, there's just a few in that game. You know, we all sort of took a pass at.
Was it, did you guys work on those critical path stories together, or was it like one person just wrote their version, they handed it off to another person?
It was pretty much that. Yeah. It was like, originally, I think Drew was going to, as the lead writer, was going to write all the crit path stuff, which was something he was doing, like, out of a noble sense, because those are not really fun to write at all. But he was really busy, and so I was a little bit ahead of schedule, so I asked him if I could take one of them, you know, and I did a pass at it. But those missions get rewritten 100 times. So, you know, I worked on the Horizon mission. I did the first pass at that. It's the first crit path one where you run into Caden or Ashley.
Yeah.
And then I did a very, very rough first pass at the suicide mission. But those, you know, were just rewritten by many people. So
when you're getting rewritten, is it you rewriting yourself, or is it like in TV where, like, the showrunner will rewrite, like, they'll finish, writer will finish an episode and they'll give it to showrunner, they'll do their pass on it and finish it. It's like, is the lead writer then finishing the stuff before it gets finalized?
No, it's not. It's not quite like the showrunner model, but it's just it will probably be given to another writer to rewrite. You know, it's sort of like part of it is just scheduling. You know, part of it is like you do that first pass, and then they just want someone with a fresh eye to come in. You know, I would say it's a bit like some features that I've encountered back when I worked in film during the development hell stage, where they're just shifting writers in it. And it's not even like, oh, this writer failed, let's get another one. It's like, we've squeezed everything we can out of this writer, let's throw his husk out back and just bring in a new one, you know. And sometimes it's very specific, like do a joke pass or whatever. But for the most part, it's just get a fresh perspective and build on what's there. And correct some of the things we don't like.
Mm. And then with, like, the side missions and NPC dialogue, was that just split up among everyone, or was that one person?
No, yeah, that's, I mean, if you're, mostly, as I say, we broke it down by character. So in the course of writing your character's acquisition and loyalty missions, you would end up writing most of those side NPCs.
Okay.
And then you would also write their dialogues on the ship, on the Normandy. And then there were a couple of, like, little side characters here and there, you know, like Joker or Yeoman Kelly Chambers, is that her name? Yeah, who were just written by, I think Joker was written mostly by Drew, the lead writer. Kelly was written by one of our level designers who wanted to try his hand at writing. So.
And he did a good job, I think.
Yeah.
I liked Kelly.
And what were you doing at BioWare at this time, Deandra?
Well, he was working on Mass Effect 2.
Yes.
I was working on the Unannounced project.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
That was canceled?
Or
is it still happening? Okay, never mind.
No, we can't talk about it.
That's all I'm saying.
So I think we skipped from BioWare to going to Carbine. So mm-hmm. What did you do in between those?
So BioWare, I had my contract at BioWare. That ended. Shortly thereafter, actually, Brian got the job at Blizzard, and we moved back to California, where I freelanced for a little bit while I was waiting to get my green card. Once I got my green card...
She's a dirty foreigner.
I am a dirty foreigner. I'm a dirty, dirty snowback, a Canadian. But actually, at that time, there was one of the... She was a combat designer, right? Yeah, one of the combat designers from Mass Effect had actually come down to Riot Games, Christina Norman, and she was kind of involved with a lot of the kind of the creative writing side at Riot, and she realized, oh, hey, we could totally use an editor. And she's like, well, hey, you living in California and knowing how to edit, and I can trust that you know good editing standards, having been taught at BioWare, we could really use an editor. So,
did they have no editors there?
They had no editors there. I was the guinea pig for that position, actually.
How big was Riot this time?
Riot was pretty large. Yeah. I would say Riot was probably like 300-400 people, I think.
Okay.
Riot was still, this is 2012, so yeah. This was, they're still pretty large. Not that they're not large now, they're gigantic now.
Yeah, well, they had already ascended to king of the internet.
Yes. Yeah, they definitely done that. But I did have a level requirement to meet in LoL. I had to reach level 15 in League of Legends, which from, I'm not super hardcore into the, like, hardcore gaming. I like my story games and whatnot, but I had my friend, I was like, okay, I need you to protect me from the people on League of Legends. He's like, we can do this. So we played a lot of League of Legends together. I thickened my skin. I got called a lot of terrible names. And I made it to level 15. I submitted my application. And
how long did it take to get to level 50?
Oh, 15. Level 15 was pretty easy. It took me a week.
Okay.
And this was not playing hardcore. I could have done it in 3 days if I really wanted to, but I needed to take breaks because it can be a harrowing experience as a brand new player that has never played a Dota or a MOBA before.
Yeah.
Like, it can be super harrowing. And I was like, oh God, why is this so mean?
And when you were playing it, were you seeing like things that you could edit in the future?
Yes. Oh, yes. They did give me a editing test, which was to edit tooltips specifically. That's what I was brought on mainly for, to edit tooltips, because there was no real standard between them, and they're just a mess. And then the character powers themselves. How do you concisely put forward what this power does in a very clear, explanatory manner without having it be like 3 paragraphs long, because some of those powers are super complicated.
Yeah.
Anybody can tell you, like, Warwick's ultimate is super, super, it's very complex. There's something that happens on one hit, and then on the next 5 hits, something else happens, and then all sorts of messiness. So, yeah, they need somebody to help try and, set some guidelines and standards and clear that up. And then, of course, for all their character bios, kind of look through those, figure out a way to get them a little more concise and a little more, I guess, in line with what they wanted their IP to be.
Was the interview process just the test?
The interview process was not just the test. I actually had a half-day interview. There's one. I had a very casual interview at first, up a couple of months before when they first gave me the test, and I was just in a room with a couple of people, just kind of chatting about, what my level was. I was a super low-level person, but I had tech writing skills because I'd also got my tech writing certificate in the meantime while I was, waiting for my green card. And so, I labeled out like what my thought process was, how information should be displayed. Again, the library helped with that as well. But yeah, after that, I had the kind of half-day interview where I had a lunch interview with a couple of the writers, and then I had another interview with kind of a senior writer, one of the producers, and then another of the senior writers, and it was a bit of a day. It was probably about, 4 or 5 hours, and after that, just waited to hear back, but they liked everything they heard, and they hired me on a contractual basis, so I was there for about 6 months as the contract guinea pig.
And did they hire more writers while you were there? Or editors?
No, I was the only editor for the time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was the only one. Publishing may have had one, but publishing and the in-game are very different.
Yeah.
They don't really intersect that much, so.
And it was mostly tooltips?
I would say tooltips was a part of it, but it was a good mix of tooltips and character bios.
Is that just like the most writing in that game?
For the most part, yeah. That's the most writing. Like, you get all the website stuff, but that's, again, handled by a different division. But for in-game writing, it's character bios and tooltips are kind of the main source of stuff. Like, creative would still handle stuff like, I do believe Udyr, for one of his skins, I think it was one of his skins, he had, like, this cool comic, like, motion comic that came out with him. Creative did that. The Jinx video, creative definitely had a huge hand in that. One of my friends was very heavily involved in that, and he was kind of main guy on that. Creative has a hand in a lot of, like, they cross over into a lot of the other mediums, but for the main part back then, most of what I did was, yeah, character bios and tooltips.
And then after Riot?
After Riot, I worked at a Chinese company called Snail Games that was trying to put out their MMO in North America, and so they needed an editor to go through their entire game and be like, you know, we had translators go through this and translate it and clean this up, and oh, it needs some cleaning up.
Yeah. How big was this game as an MMO?
This is like a full-scale MMO, and it's a very Age of Wushu is a very complicated MMO.
And they wanted one editor?
There was a writer. One of my friends was one of the writers. We had a couple of other translators, but I think I was the only editor. We had other translators and whatnot on there that would actually further clean up the translations that we originally got from China.
Yeah.
So translators for the translations, and then the lead writer to go and kind of, or the senior writer, Gavin, to help, you know, get the story in line, like see all the little bits and pieces and be like, okay, let's streamline this and make this an actual story, and then me to clean up afterwards, and then to also do a lot of the marketing editing as well. So I handled both sides. I handled the creative side and the marketing side.
Is this the first time you did marketing editing?
No, I'd done freelance stuff
before for
marketing. It's not my favoritest of all the things, but it's perfectly fine and I enjoy it.
And after Snail?
After Snail, I was I had a 3-month contract at a tiny Japanese company called XSEED that put out really awesome smaller games. Like they did the Senran Kagura series. They did what do they have coming out? They have Akiba's Trip coming out. They have some really, really awesome... I'm trying to think of some of their awesome titles, but yeah, they have cool little bits here and there.
Yeah,
and I think one of the things that you at Snail and XSEED mm-hmm. had to deal with in editing was cultural cultural issues. You know, when you bring entertainment from another country.
Yes, these were more strictly localization jobs. So when you localize, you know, a game in another language, like what do you translate over and what don't you translate over, and cultural biases, cultural differences. You know, what does one culture think is acceptable, another culture may not find so good.
This was you and not like the second round of translators they had hired? This is mostly you doing that?
It was all of us. It was the second round of translators and me and the writer. We all kind of powwowed together to be like, this probably will not translate well, so maybe we should change that a little bit.
I had a transition plan, but...
Yeah. I was about to say, well, so from there I went to XSEED, and XSEED was a much nicer, you know, it's a tiny little studio, it's really tight-knit, they're really cool people, and it's interesting working on a smaller scale game, too, like, you just get a little more personal, and again, their games are not, it was not as rough as Age of Wushu and all the craziness that's in there, you know, it was a lot of fun, but unfortunately, like, that was only a quick three-month contract, but... Fortunately, right after that, Carbine was starting to hire up a bunch of editors because they needed to have WildStar edited. Specifically, they needed editors to work with localization to make sure that all the strings got sent over for translation and, you know, flip the audit flag and whatnot. So I got hired in just after my contract ended with XSEED, and I've been there for about a year and a half now.
Do companies usually, in your experience, hire editors after a production has already started for a while or been going for a while?
It depends, actually. It depends on the studio, and it depends on... It takes something for a studio to realize that they, like, writers cannot edit themselves. It definitely does. But once they do, if they can get...
But they will try.
They will try. Oh, they will try and get writers to edit themselves, and it's always the worst idea ever. So...
And you would rather be there at the beginning.
I would rather be there at the beginning. Even if you don't think that, you know, you're like, oh, well, they haven't written anything. I don't need an editor. No, the editor should be there right at the beginning. So that way they kind of know, like, what the IP is. They get a feel for it, and they can keep that knowledge. Like, as an editor, when you're editing a piece of work, you always have knowledge of what the IP is, who the characters are, making sure that the character voice is consistent, you know. Is this something this character would do and say? You need to kind of be there at the outset to keep all those things in line and really truly know them. You want to be playing levels as early as you can. Like, before I actually edit a piece of content, even in WildStar, I'll try and play through it. Like, I'll play through a zone on the dev side and kind of see what the quest transition is and kind of get a feel for the entire zone, so that way when I edit it, I have a context for what the lines are and why things are being said.
So what are the common mistakes that writers make?
Ooh, so
that you always have to fix.
Writers, everybody has their own quirks, right?
But you probably see common things, like things that pop up.
You've worked at a wide variety of...
I've worked at a wide variety of things. I will say that the most common... I wouldn't even say it's a mistake, but the most common quirk of writers is that... And I don't blame anybody for this, but there's a point where you can't see the forest for the trees. When you're writing something, you get very attached to it, and you have to. That's how you make good writing. You have to be passionate about it. But there comes a point where you really can't see the forest for the trees, and you need somebody else's eyes looking at that saying, oh, this is great. Like, this idea is great, but it's possibly not being executed in the best way possible. And it's hard hearing that. You know, you always want to give constructive criticism. You always want to make sure that they know that this is not a personal thing. But sometimes you just need to fix those little bits, and it's the writer's job to take that with grace and aplomb and try and deal with that, because that's writing. That's how you get better. But a lot of writers, they because, again, it's your baby, and I understand. It's absolutely your baby. So hearing somebody say, yeah, your child's cute, except for that, like, giant mole growing out the side of its neck, it might actually... What was that? What was that in Seinfeld? The goiter?
Yeah.
It might turn into a goiter there. You don't want to hear that. Your child's perfect, right? It's the most perfect, beautiful little baby you've ever birthed. Except that it's not. And maybe you should just have that looked at and fixed that. And then your baby will be perfect and wonderful. Like, always keep that in mind. That's just a general writer thing. And again, it's born out of passion and a love of what you do. And No blames, but...
It would come out anyway, and it's better to have it come from inside the studio for...
Exactly. Yeah, it's better
the audience picks it up.
Yeah. It's better to see the errors beforehand and fix them than it is afterwards to have people screaming on the forums being like, what were you guys smoking? Oh my God. Why did you do this?
People are seeing that now with, like, early access, where, like, they're seeing all the mistakes that people would never get to see before. And, like, how would you get this way? It was like, well, this always happened. You just never saw it.
Yeah.
Early access is great, but it's kind of fun to see, oh, this is what you're doing, but why are you guys doing it this idiot way? No, it's not done. Trust us. There's, like, several more layers to go.
There you go. No, I play broken games at work all day long. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go home and buy a broken game on Steam.
I was going to say,
I like her version of how she's giving notes, where she's like, you know, oh, it's really good, but the executions, you know, could be better, as opposed to the way I get critiques from her, which is, this sucks.
That's because... So,
well, you know each other. Like, that's the same way we do. We're very critical of each other. Where it's like, I don't need to boost him up before I tear him down. No. I can just tear him down because it's quicker.
I love you. We wake up together. Yeah. I don't need to sugarcoat anything. Yeah. When I think.
And then you tell me I suck.
Well, I think the thing that he's possibly referring to is he had me read a short story of his, and I referenced an author that we don't think very highly of, and
she said I was writing like him, and I'm like, what?
I was like, it's kind of like this, and he's like, what do you mean it's like this? Oh, God, what do I need to change? I'm like, you need to get a little closer to what your writing is and a little less, because he's trying to do something that he doesn't normally do.
I was writing outside my normal style, my normal prose style, I guess.
Yeah. But I like to say it's like a marriage, the writer-editor relationship. He writes a bunch of stuff, and then I tell him why it's wrong.
That's right. It's like a typical marriage.
Just like from a typical place of love. Marriage. Yeah. Yes. All born of love and trust.
Mm-hmm. You're just trying to help improve everyone.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Before I forget, so at Carbine, was the interview process the same as the other ones for editing?
No, actually. My interview process at Carbine was actually much more chill than all the other, like, interviews that I've been in. Like, I was in a panel interview for Snail, a smaller one for Xseed, but for Carbine, I submitted my application, and then I had a phone interview set up, and I just chatted with the lead writer, and it seemed to go really, really well, and he's like, okay, this seems cool, and he's like, yeah, well, we'll bring you in just for an on-site, just to do the ultimate sniff test. You want to see somebody in person just to make sure you're like, you sound great on the phone, but when I meet you...
Can we work together?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Are you crazy?
Do you have a third arm growing out of the top of your head?
And even then, that's fine, but are you crazy?
Yeah. So, will you wear pants when you come into office?
I think you're allowed to do that.
When everyone else is wearing pants.
Yeah. Pants are optional.
You get, like, at least three pantsless days, I believe. No, I had a really quick on-site interview with him. He kind of showed me tool set. Carbine uses proprietary tools, and after that, it's like, cool, okay, we'll get back to you. And a couple of days later, they're like, yeah, we'd like to extend you an offer. So I didn't actually have to do a test for that one either, which was interesting. So, yeah.
And so you mentioned the proprietary tools you use. So I want to know for both you guys, what tools do you use when like you're editing and writing? Like what do the companies use? Because at Dolphin for writing, we used Google's spreadsheets.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was Google Docs and Skype.
Google Docs.
But we wrote all of our dialogue and everything in spreadsheets, which was a change from writing in Final Draft or screenwriting software.
That sounds about right. BioWare has proprietary tools. Riot has proprietary tools. Carbine has proprietary tools. For Snail and Xseed, it was Excel documents.
Are all the tools basically the same, or are they different? How are they different?
That depends on which tools programmer is building it. Each one is a special, unique snowflake all to itself. For an idea of the BioWare tools, I'd say go to the Neverwinter Nights.
It's a very old tool set now, but it's
or a more modern take, the Dragon Age tool set.
Yep. Yeah, I was going to say they actually have unique tools per team. So like the Mass Effect conversation editor was totally different than the Dragon Age conversation editor, and same, you know, Blizzard, like between StarCraft and Diablo, just different tools, different engine.
If you want to see what StarCraft was written in, just go to the Galaxy editor, and that's it.
Yep, we shipped the tools with the game.
Yeah,
so. Are those the perfect tools you would like to work with, or did you have other ones you would prefer to work in?
Well, so like in the case of StarCraft, you know, the tools programmer that had written the conversation editor was like in the office right next to me. So I would just kind of mosey over every morning with my coffee and be like, "How you doing today? You know, I kind of was hoping we could add a feature like this." You know, and he's great. I mean, he would just do it that afternoon, bam. You know, and I'd get a new build and there'd be a new feature in the tools. So I don't think any tool set is perfect by any means, but they're, you know, they're over a timeline, they evolve into something that matches your work style, you know?
Yeah.
I think the Mass Effect tools were really, really good. That was probably my favorite tool set that I've used.
Why?
It was just very intuitive. And, you know, it was just the way that it functioned, you know, with keyboard shortcuts and stuff, you weren't fighting the tool set to get your writing in. It was kind of like the tool set wouldn't slow you down. You know, you could write as fast or as slow as you felt. That would be the short answer, I guess.
Okay. So we sped through it, but how did you get from BioWare to Blizzard?
So when I was finishing up on Mass Effect 2, basically, Deandra really did not like living in Edmonton.
BioWare is amazing. Edmonton is less so.
Yeah. Well, it gets down to 40 below, and, you know, in the winter, the sun comes up around, 10:30, goes down at 3.
Yeah.
And the winter is, like, 10 months. So so there's that, you know, and I think we both really liked BioWare. We both were not super big fans of Edmonton. I mean, it's a fine city. Don't send me hate mail.
sorry, Edmontonians.
It just wasn't for us.
No.
So, you know, and along with that, Drew Karpyshyn, who had been my lead on Mass Effect 2, he was leaving to go to Austin, and I was kind of like, I really enjoyed working with Drew, you know, so that was like one less reason to stay. And so I saw that Blizzard was looking for like a cinematic director, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I have directing on my resume, and it's still in-game, so I'm not going to make the mistake of, you know, going back to Hollywood. So I contacted them. And what's funny is now, having worked at Blizzard for many years, I know that they wouldn't have even considered me for that for a second, because, you know, Blizzard cinematics are like big, giant, epic guys with capes and big swords, you know. And my director's reel was like this little kid's cartoon show for PBS that I directed, right?
But you know, brought the emotion.
What's that?
You could have brought the emotion.
That's
to it.
Right. No, that would have been my pitch if they would ever have talked to me about it, but they didn't. but one of their recruiters actually called me back or called me and left a message saying, the film thing, I don't know about that, but you're a writer at BioWare, and we actually are looking for a writer for one of our teams. So, you know, are you interested in that? And I was like, oh, yes, please. So then they set up a series of phone interviews.
What were those like?
That was interesting. That was very interesting. The first one was with Dustin Browder, who is the game director of StarCraft, which I think is how I found out that it was StarCraft. Like, the recruiters didn't actually tell me what project, I think, as I recall. Cagey. But
had you been playing Blizzard games before this?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah.
We were playing World of Warcraft together at that time, actually.
Oh.
It was just after Lich King launched, and we both rolled Draenei. You were a mage, and I was a priest. Both female Draenei, too.
Hmm. Yes. So people would always...
We troll them.
Call us the twins. And,
yes.
And then Deandra would start saying, you know, actually, we live together. And, you know, and they'd be like, oh, my God, it's amazing. These two
yes.
female Draenei
we live together. Yeah, we make out all the time.
And I'm like, it's not what you think.
Reality is so much less sexy.
But, yeah, so I talked to Dustin on the phone, you know, and that was a good conversation. You know, it was typical interview questions like, well, BioWare seems awesome. Why do you want to leave BioWare, you know? And then they set up a second interview for me with Chris Metzen, who's the vice president of franchise development for Blizzard, and the guy who was one of two people that wrote the original StarCraft. So that was, you know, that was an interesting. I don't remember that interview as well, but it was interesting. He you know.
You were very nervous at first.
He just on the phone. He just sounded like kind of a surfer dude, which is funny now knowing him. I don't think he's ever surfed a day in his life, but he's
really.
Yeah, he was like, hey man, how's it going? Like, yeah, let's talk about writing Word, you know, like, but those seemed to go well. So then they brought me down for an interview. So I went and interviewed, and I interviewed from 10, to noon basically. So there was the first group that came in at 10 was three people. All basically vice presidents, but developers, not like a guy with a big cigar yeah. and a business suit, you know. And so it was, you know, they were asking, they very specifically wanted to know how much I played Blizzard games. They wanted to make sure that I was like really a fan and not just like, oh, I just need a job, you know.
Yeah.
And then the second round was the game director of StarCraft, a writer on StarCraft, and a writer from Diablo. And so they just asked... Actually, the two writers didn't say much. Dustin, the game director, really ran that interview, and he's a tough interviewer. He's tough.
What was tough about it?
So I've been to a number of interviews now where I'm on the same side of the table as Dustin. So I've seen him, you know, be tough. But yeah, I mean, like, this is a pretty standard one, is like, you know, what's your biggest criticism of the original StarCraft? And then you say what it is, and they go, well, how would you fix it? And I'm like, oh, God. But yeah, no, he would ask a lot of questions about how, you know, the writer would interact with the team, or, you know, do you think an RTS really needs a story, you know, which is, these are tough things to sort of navigate that minefield, you know, during an interview when you don't know the people in the room.
Were you asked that question?
Oh yeah.
What'd you say?
I don't remember.
What would you say now?
Yeah, I mean, I think, not every game benefits from a story. I think some games would be hurt by having narrative in them. But, you know, a game without context at all, like a game like Tetris, which I know some people point out to me sometimes, somewhere in the origin of that game, it was supposed to have a story or be part of a story or something. But a game like Tetris doesn't need a context. You have the full context, right? The universe is filling up with blocks and you've got to get rid of them, right? Bam, context. But, you know, a lot of games, it's like you want to feel like your choices have meaning and the things that you're doing, that you have motivations to do these things. RTS, you know, that, I think that's as true for RTS as it is for a role-playing game. It's just the amount of story and how it's delivered varies wildly by genre. But
so when you were interviewing, did you say like a writing sample or was... It was all just interviews.
Oh yeah, that's sorry. I skipped that step. There they asked me if I wanted to apply as a writer. I had the phone interview. Then they sent me. I had the two phone interviews, and then they sent me a test, which is when I definitely knew that I was talking about working on StarCraft, because it was a StarCraft test. So it was a very short test. They, you know, basically I did it in a day.
What was on the test?
It was the first half of two. Cinematics from StarCraft II, And they wanted me to write the second half of each one to sort of see how I would carry through.
Did you? So those were cinemas that already existed for the first game?
No, they were from StarCraft II. So oh, okay. it wasn't released yet. But one of them was on on YouTube for some reason. So I did see it, but I didn't. I mean, you know,
yeah.
I still wrote my own version of it. But
you were just maintaining like the voice of the original thing, and then.
Yeah, I think it was to see what my thinking was as far as how the dramatic premise of each cutscene would end, and then to see how I maintained the voice and
probably little bits of lore here and there. Like, what do you think is important in the cinematic? Because what's important in the StarCraft universe in that cinematic may not be something that you would pick out if you're not a StarCraft fan.
Right, right. Yeah. So one of them was there's a cinematic early on where Raynor is sitting in a bar drinking. And his old buddy Tychus comes in and basically has a business proposition for him, right? Like, there's these crazy artifacts out there, and there's these nutty scientists who'll give us a lot of money for them. You know, let's do it, partner. And there's a little bit of like, oh, I thought you were in jail. I thought I'd never see you again, you know, stuff like that. So that was the first half was written, and I had to figure out how to conclude it.
And then you were brought into StarCraft? After that?
Yeah, I went on to StarCraft as a senior writer.
How far along were they?
I started in July 2009, and the game released in July 2010. So 1 year from release.
Jeez.
So it was pretty far along. And, you know, most of the cinematics were completely done. So those were, it was an interesting, rather than being like a writing job that was about like vision, this was very much like problem solving. Because I had these giant immutable cinematics that were, you know, sort of periodically appear in the game that could not change. And then the missions could change. You know, it was about half recorded in voiceover already, which meant changing existing voiceover is expensive, but but they could do it. the other half was first pass written, but not even recorded. So it was like sort of changing all the stuff in between these big blocks of unchangeable stuff.
That sounds like what it's mostly like when you bring writers into games where you're just trying to connect two disparate, like, how does this impossible thing happen to this impossible thing within the story?
And exactly.
Which, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of games are written that way where they'll bring the writer in the last 3 months and just sort of like, here's a bunch of levels, you know.
Make it work.
Yeah, figure it out.
But even when games have writers all from the beginning, like the Uncharted series, like they had the boat level from the very beginning, but they never knew how they would get to the boat level.
Yeah, that kind of stuff definitely happens in game development, I think. Like, it's people are like, this is a cool idea. We just should do it, you know, we'll figure it out later.
And then later comes, and then you're like, oh, shit,
yeah.
What do I do?
Oh, no. Well, sometimes you can figure out how to incorporate it,
yeah,
you know, seamlessly. And then other times you're like, I don't know. We're kind of screwed.
When we found that out for the first time, that's like what happens, or at least sometimes happens. Like, we were blown away and could not believe that it was people were as successful as they had been in making it work.
And then, so you went on then to do the first expansion for StarCraft, and then you moved on to Diablo.
So, I did Heart of the Swarm, yeah, and then when that finished, I moved over to the Diablo team for that game's first expansion, Reaper of Souls.
We worked on Heart of the Swarm. Sorry,
no.
We'll get to Diablo. Heart of the Swarm. Was that direction still was set when they started production on it, or were you able to help steer the ship with that a bit more?
Oh yeah, no, we had some very big, vague ideas at the start about what we wanted to do, but even then there was a one cutscene that was pretty much done that was like, that can't change, right? But everything else was sort of on the table, so we really figured it out on the fly, which was great. It was a lot of fun. It's very collaborative.
Who makes that decision? Like, who is the head of the person deciding, like, we're going to have this cutscene and this is what's going to be inside of it? Like, who is deciding that?
Well, I mean, ideally, it would be the game director and the lead writer. In that particular case, I think those cinematics, the big pre-rendered ones that had been sort of moving very ponderously through development for years before I got there, I think those were probably written by Chris Metzen. And Chris, you know, Chris sort of has the extended universe of StarCraft inside his head. So
How'd you get to Diablo? Like, were you going to stay on StarCraft?
Yeah, my my original plan was to stay on StarCraft, but the Diablo team had been looking for a lead writer the entire time I'd been at Blizzard. I mean, I'd been at Blizzard for 3 years at that point, and that team had been looking for a lead writer for 3 years. And it was a combination of they couldn't seem to find anyone that the team liked. You know, it's very important at Blizzard. I think it's the same at Carbine that the team has to sort of really want to work with someone.
Yeah.
Especially for that amount of time you're going to be working together.
Yes, exactly. So
got to make sure everybody can get along and play nice.
That's right. And they seemed to like me. And they had been struggling with story, you know, in Diablo 3. I think that game has probably gotten a few unfair knocks in story and writing, but it's gotten some fair knocks in story and writing as well, right? So yeah. They had been struggling, and the lead designer, Kevin Martins, wanted to bring me over. Interestingly, Kevin was the lead designer on Jade Empire, so he's the guy that like pulled me off of Dragon Age before I ever worked on it many, many years earlier. So I agreed to come over and help them out. I felt like, you know, StarCraft was in a pretty good place by the end of Heart of the Swarm. Like there was a lot of stuff that we had to do in Heart of the Swarm that should have happened in Wings, but it just didn't, you know, in terms of setting up the sort of meta story and the overarching villain and all of that. So we had done all that, and then I felt like the Protoss expansion of StarCraft would be able to, I mean, wouldn't be easy. I'm not suggesting it was easy for that team to make, but it would be able to sort of breathe in its own space a little more. So I felt pretty good about going over to Diablo. And to be honest, the Blizzard game that I probably have played the most, well, it's probably a tie between World of Warcraft and Diablo 2, yeah. But I had played a lot of D2, so yes. I was kind of excited.
This is a question for both of you, ooh. But do you think writers should know about like programming and design?
I think you should definitely be aware of it. It actually does help if you're a writer or an editor to know about design and how design functions and, you know, design limitations, because that's only going to help you with your constraints. Truly good game writing is born of constraints, at least from an editor's perspective. Brian could probably...
Oh, yeah, I would agree.
Yeah. I was going to say, yeah, so knowing about... absolutely knowing about design and do you know what, even art limitations, because again, art can limit you as well. You sometimes, you know, maybe you want this giant Michael Bay explosion and art's gonna be like, ha, do you know how expensive that is? I don't think you know
not
how expensive that app is. Nope, not
and you'll be
happen.
Taking their time away from doing something else.
Yeah, and especially if you're releasing on something like an Xbox or a PS3, like they only have so much capacity. Like you can't get that giant Michael Bay explosion, otherwise you're gonna just go into two discs and it's gonna be a giant pile of pain. Knowing about programming, I think, is always good, because again, you want to always appreciate the thing that your fine programmers do for you. They are the guys in the background in the offices slaving away, trying to make sure shit runs in the background, and they do get a little unsung here and there, so I always try and show appreciation for my programmers and love for them, because they do a lot of good heavy grunt work, and being aware of what they do, maybe not, like, if I don't know how to code in C++, it's not going to affect my job. But I should be aware that it's probably a hard thing to do and requires time and skill.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I mean, programming, I don't think it would be... I don't think it would help you very much as a game writer. Although you do have to... And I think if you're an in-house writer, you will probably need to do some very light scripting.
Yes.
So it's kind of good to be familiar with just that, you know, very, very... I mean, programmers would laugh at the idea that scripting is even close to programming. But, yes. You know, it's like just some very light stuff to kind of like set and get variables and put conditionals on certain lines of dialogue.
Yeah.
But for design, I think it's real. I mean, if you're an in-house writer, you're essentially a type of designer. Some studios... are calling their writers
narrative
designers or content designers or creative designers.
Creative designers.
They
seem to change definition based on what studio you're at.
Yeah. It's just a lot of names, you know. But I think, you know, there is a reason for that, because you work really closely with design and you have to understand their their priorities and the things that they care about. Because, you know, there's this tension that happens a lot of times between gameplay where it's like the player wants to be in control of what happens, right? I mean, the idea of playing a game is beating it by taking control of your environment in some way. And narrative is like this other force that is, it won't give you control, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, there's stuff like player story and emergent story and all that stuff, but at its core level, it's someone going, let me tell you a great story about a guy, right? You know? And so in order for that tension to make its way into the game in a healthy way, the writers and designers need to work together really well. So it's definitely good the more you know about it and the more that you understand what they're trying to achieve.
How much programming and like game design were you guys aware of when you started?
Oh, I knew what programming was.
Yeah.
I could tell you a dictionary definition of it. Design was kind of a mysterious beast to me. Like, I was aware of it. I was aware that there are game designers and they, you know, did special magical things to make the world what it is. But I didn't really have a very thorough concept of it, I guess. I kind of learned that just on the job. I don't know about you.
No, that's the same, yeah. I was vaguely aware that there was a thing called programming. And coming out of film and animation, to me, a designer was a person who... like a character designer who like draws, you know, so it was really sort of weird to hear people, you know, who didn't draw be called designers. But yeah, I definitely, that's just stuff that we've learned on the job, I think.
And follow up question to Deandra, because I forgot to ask, when were you aware of people making games, that people made games?
I think I was always generally aware of it. Like, I guess I was kind of born in the... I was born in the 80s. I was born in the video game generation, right? So games were always a thing, like, not necessarily at my house. I didn't get access to them till much later in my life because my parents thought that, you know, it would lead to devil worship and, you know, sacrificing goats, but...
How right they were.
Yes. Shh, nobody needs to know what we do in our backyard. But, yeah, I was always aware of, like, games as a thing, and I obviously knew, like, somebody had to make this, and it's an intriguing concept, but again, it was much like film in my mind. I'm like, psh, I'm never gonna live in L.A. and do something like that. I'm gonna stay in my tiny little cold-ass town in Canada and live a humble life and maybe be, I don't know.
Work at a library.
Well, that was the second dream. The first dream was, I guess I'll be a scientist because I'll make mom and dad happy. And then it was like, I'll work in the library and make me happy. And actually, that would be a pretty good existence. But other callings took place.
So have you guys experienced a lot of different philosophies in how game studios handle their narratives? Or do they seem to be more or less the same ideology, more or less?
If you want to think about it, I can...
Yeah, you go first.
No, yeah, I think they're... I've only worked at two game studios. Well, unless you count Boogerman, but
count Boogerman.
That was...
the shady little North Hollywood.
That was Little Gangsta Entertainment was the name of that production
Very
studio.
Very classy.
Yeah, and it was Little, L-I apostrophe L. Anyway...
two studios are very big for narrative.
BioWare and Blizzard. BioWare, I think, was definitely more narrative driven. So the writers would start work early on and you know, start figuring out the flow along with the game director and other people, obviously, the flow of the game. And then design would start to come into the process a little bit later. And so sometimes some of the level designers that I worked with, you know, would feel like, well, I really wish we'd been in the mix earlier because, you know, I think this level could work better this way. And it would, you know, usually that was okay. We could figure out how to retrofit something. But Blizzard is I would say more collaborative, which is not to imply that the people at BioWare don't collaborate. It's just that it's more, the narrative is set earlier, so it's sort of, there's just questions that are already answered by the time people come on the project. Blizzard is sort of like just a giant landslide all at once. Like, everybody's going, right? And the designers are designing and the writers are writing. So it can be a little harder to ring any sort of order from that chaos, but it gives you a lot of great opportunities to be spontaneous. So
I'm still trying to think. Like, I think the narrative process just really changes based on the kind of game that you're making. Like, the narrative process at BioWare that we had, again, very iterative. At Riot, it's, again, very collaborative. You know, you all get together, you all work on an idea, you kind of work on a concept together. If you're writing VO, that was another thing. I helped edit the VO lines for the characters in-game. That's another bit of writing that they do, definitely.
Very important.
Yes, very, very important.
In terms of money.
Yeah, very, very important. But yeah, you all kind of collaborate and work on that. At Snail, again, it was the translators working with the writers to find a good medium of keeping the essence of the story in line, but maybe changing pertinent details, as we discussed beforehand. Same with Xseed, because that kind of falls in the same line. At Carbine, it is writers and designers, artists, all working together. You know, you have like a feature pitch, and you all talk about like what you want this idea to be, and you all work together to, you know, create a common goal, and stuff gets started all at the same time. Like, you'll have the designers designing, and then they'll send, you know, stuff off for like narrative reviews, and you know, the narrative review will like give back certain writing feedback, and then the designers will either implement it, or you know, you go back and forth, and it's again everybody kind of working at once to create a common goal.
Have you guys ever had experience where like programming or gameplay design is like waiting for writers to finish writing something? Has that ever happened?
Not really, because so for us, like, all of our stuff is voiceover, obviously, right? And so, you know, once the voiceover is done in English, it goes to Loke, and they translate it into many languages and begin recording, you know, voiceover in many other languages. So the writing actually has to be done. Designers can patch change, like you know, when you start up your game and it starts updating, that's a designer who decided to make the boss fight 5% easier or whatever, right? Like, they can actually patch changes after the game is released.
Yeah.
So oftentimes writing is in this weird vice where you can't start too early before everyone else, but you have to finish much earlier, right?
Yeah.
And then you spend the rest of the project, like, people want to change stuff, and it will affect the writing that's already been done and translated into 12 languages and recorded in 12 languages. And so now you're more like a goalie. You're like trying to figure out how to help them get the change they want to fix whatever they're trying to fix without screwing up your story.
So what kind of fixes are you doing that could not, like, that will make the smallest ripples?
Well, I mean, so like, you know, if a designer said, as a hypothetical, like, oh, you know, I have this level and I think it's not very exciting. And so I'd like to add, you know, killer clowns that just spawn out of nowhere and attack you while laughing maniacally. And you know, you're like, the story that you're telling, this was a very somber, you're going to rescue a small child who's been kidnapped or something, right? And it was a serious, heavy subject matter, and like, clowns just don't quite fit the bill, you know? So what will happen, in my experience, is the designer will come to you and say, this is my problem, this is how I'm fixing it. Killer clowns, right? And mm-hmm. And so that's where you have to go, well, okay, let's go back to what the problem was, right? The level was kind of boring, right? And how can we make the level more exciting while keeping the heavy, you know, feel that you need? And you know, that was just a silly example. Like, designers obviously get it too. They think tonally as well, but it's, so you're like, okay, no killer clowns, please, let's not do that.
Yeah.
And so then you begin the process of figuring out how to solve their problem without screwing your story.
Since you work on a lot of MMOs, have you found anything that MMOs do particularly well in terms of storytelling or narrative that no other genre would really do as well?
Again, a great question.
We have little experience with MMOs, so I can't...
The only thing I could think of was just the player's narrative.
Yes.
That the writer would not write at all.
The journey, I think the journey that you go through as a player, like, especially if you're doing something like raiding and you see kind of the story unfold from there, it does get very visceral for you. Like, for a little bit during Burning Crusade, I was a hardcore raider in World of Warcraft, and that felt very real to me, like, from my own experience. Like, it's just, I think you have a lot of opportunity to really kind of dig into a person and make it like their story, like their journey through this, and it does get very, very personal because you think of your character as yourself walking through this world, and so there's a vast opportunity for story to really be meaningful. Not to say, again, single-player games also have that, but sometimes when you're playing a character, it's still yourself. Like, Commander Shepard, my Commander Shepard is still me.
Yeah.
Like, and I made those choices and whatnot, but there's just such a variety of things that I can do. I love MMOs because there's such a variety of things that I can do. Like, I love crafting. I am unabashedly a huge crafting whore. Like, I will get all my skill points up. I want to learn every recipe. I love achievements too, so I'll like sit there and patiently go fishing in different ponds to get different things.
We are completionists in that we will like explore every single room and find everything, and like playing like Last of Us, I have to murder everyone so I can search all these drawers and find every item in here.
Oh, but yeah.
Achievements, oh. No.
He can tell you, even in Diablo, when we play Diablo together, he'll be like, okay, baby, maybe when we play through the story, we don't explore the entire dungeon. We found the second entrance. I'm like, no, but there's treasure. You don't understand.
Oh, no, exploring for treasure, I can see. You're exploring to push back the black mask.
Yes.
And see on the mini-map that you can see every room.
And treasure. There's like, treasure.
It's
and
a randomly
pass.
Generated map.
There's, yes, but you can...
It's, when we leave, it's going to disappear.
Yes, but you can still guesstimate what's kind of around those corners. Once you see enough of those maps, you can kind of like intuit like, oh, this is probably going to lead to this kind of hallway, and there might be treasure or champion packs or a green item or maybe a legendary.
Well,
what if I had missed a legendary?
No, I'm all for exploring for those things, though.
Okay.
Brian, RTSs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can those do storytelling? Is there anything RTSs do with storytelling better than any other genre, do you think?
I don't think anyone has ever asked that question.
Yeah.
I don't think so, yeah, because storytelling in an RTS is extremely hard.
The only thing I can think of would be a story of your units, because no other game really has that scale to it, but...
Right.
No one's really done that.
So and the problem is that as a game, design sensibility, it's important that the designers teach you in an RTS to be willing to throw away your units, right? Yeah. Like if you, if you were able to name your individual tanks in StarCraft, you make a siege tank, and you're like, this one's named Jim, right? And then you're not going to want Jim to die, right? And so that would be terrible because you need to be throwing your units into the fray and making more, right? Like, we will make more. So the way the game itself works actually sort of distances you from these tiny little figures that you're looking down on from a godlike perspective. I don't know that RTS does a form of storytelling better than anything else, but I think that there are stories that play very well in an RTS that might not necessarily play as well in like an RPG. So, for instance, an RTS can tell the story of a great war, right? And like, the personalities of the generals and armies, going from planet to planet or marching across a great plain or whatever. That's all stuff that lends itself very well to RTS. Whereas, in an RPG... if you had a role-playing game where you're telling the story of this character who founds a kingdom, great, but that is going to mostly happen off-screen, right? Like this character is going to be fighting trolls and crafting potions and doing whatever. But if you sort of have these advisors show up every once in a while and go, should we build a wall on the eastern border? And you go, yeah, build a wall over there, right? It's a cool idea, but it's just an intellectual off-screen idea. So I maybe that answers the question. Maybe RTS actually does do something better than anything else for story, and that's telling the story of a big, sweeping war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm satisfied by that answer, as am I.
This is kind of just a switching of topics, but, like, what were you, like, creative-wise, like, what inspires you?
I get my inspiration from a variety of sources. I grew up, absolutely, probably the most important thing in my life creatively happened when I was 7. The reason I'm sitting here right now is because I'm very old. I went to the theater and saw episode 4, A New Hope, when I was 7 years old. And I remember every second of that experience.
He actually has a much better story where he did a follow-up viewing.
Oh, yeah. The next weekend, I snuck off and went to see the movie on my own at 7, right? And back then, they would let a 7-year-old kid in the theater by himself.
And this is in downtown Boston. Let's just...
Oh, yeah. So I went...
That caveat
and
there.
A picture.
And I just sat there. I think I went in the 11 o'clock show was the first one. And I just sat there. And the movie... They didn't kick you out of the theater between movies. So it just would loop. And I was just watching. I was there at like 9 o'clock at night when my mother came storming in, having finally figured out that I must be watching Star Wars. And like, it was during the cantina scene, I remember. And she dragged me out. So yeah, I was dedicated to Star Wars. But and then I started reading quite a lot after, you know, after that. I guess most of what I read was science fiction and fantasy. But I certainly, you know, I enjoyed reading other things. I mean, Watership Down was an amazing book, you know. So
it's a book about bunnies.
It's little cute
What's
rabbits.
Gonna happen?
Nothing bad could happen.
No, it's bunnies.
So, yeah, I think it was mostly reading. I didn't get really into TV back then, because back then TV was like a creative wasteland, you know.
Yeah. yes.
And I don't even mean that from like some like ultra cool, like I don't watch TV kind of. I mean, like, no, it was a wasteland. There was a couple good shows. MASH was good.
Mm-hmm.
But these days, yeah, I mean, I take my inspiration from all over, including TV. I became a devotee of The Wire recently. I finally
very
watched
good.
It. Oh my God.
Very good show.
So good.
I'm still just starting season 4. He's watching it again with me and he gets all excited when we get to certain points. He's like, oh, you don't know what you're in for.
Do you think like that, why aren't we getting games that are like The Wire, where it's not like, not about like, a cop game masquerading as like a story-driven game, like a game where you're doing, like, I guess L.A. Noire would be the closest thing, but like just we're doing all this
monotony.
What game executives would say, like, there's all the, like, there's no gameplay to play there, but like doing like a huge investigation and like dealing with the politics of it.
Like, why haven't we gotten a political game yet?
That's a good question. I think there's some simulations that are
there's like probably some like really small indie games.
But yeah.
There's like the comedy, like the politic ones. Like those games came out in Steam every
for
time
the election.
Elections. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like a good political thriller game.
And I do have to say, when I started playing the last Saints Row game, I was the president of the United States. So
that's true.
That
true.
Was
we
clearly a political.
Saints Row.
Yeah. But I...
You also had a dubstep gun, I do believe.
I did. I had a dubstep gun.
You had a lot of things in that game.
Yeah. But I don't know. I think I think it is the gameplay issue. You know, I think people... The pace that people expect to play a game at these days is much higher than... Like it was back, you know, I went back and tried to play Baldur's Gate 2, which was an incredible game. The one that actually sort of pushed me into the games industry. And it's hard. I mean, it's very slow. And like you run into one minor hobgoblin in a dark alley somewhere and it's like a 25-minute fight and you're nearly dead at the end. You know, it's like, I don't think I could do that. I put 200 hours in this game in the 90s, but I couldn't do it now.
Ain't no one got the time.
Yep. So I don't know if you had any other...
Oh, things that inspire me. Yeah. Again, books are very important. Books are very, very important to me. I would say movies less... Again, movies do inspire me, but movies less so. But definitely way back in the day, I was always an avid reader. Fairy tales, Greek mythology, kind of, you know, the basis of where all our stories come from, stuff like that. I loved all that. I know for book series that really kind of shaped me as a person, strangely enough, Wheel of Time, because that is actually, and you can say what you will about Wheel of Time, I take fair criticism on that, but it was the one book series that actually got me on the internet talking to, you know, random strangers on the internet, and stranger danger.
And that always goes well.
Well, you know, stranger danger aside, I've had friends from those message boards, like, to this day. I've known them since I was 16, and I am right now. But for a while, I've known these people, and that was actually kind of one of my stepping stones to online gaming, which kind of, you know, led me to things like City of Heroes and World of Warcraft and, you know, Tabula Rasa, if anybody remembers that. And if they do... Bonus points for you.
I know the name.
Aren't the servers still running? someone's still playing that game.
I would be impressed if the servers are still running on that.
It might be.
But, yeah, Wheel of Time, and of course, his Dark Materials, the Philip Pullman series, I would not have a husband if not for that, so.
That was our first or second conversation was about that.
Yes. Mm. We have all our animals are named after characters from that series.
These days, what's like an average day of work for you guys?
You first.
Oh, fine. that's weirdly a very hard question to answer because there's almost no average day as a writer on a big game team. It depends on where you are in the process. Very early on, there's a lot of just talking to people and sort of it's like, you know, you're in one room brainstorming ideas and then you're in another room pitching stuff because you want to get all the artists excited about it and sort of get them, you know, kind of on board with what you and the other people in the brainstorming meeting just came up with that you're going to probably change next week. But like, you know, it's just a lot of communication and talking. And then there's a little section in the middle where you're actually like sitting at a computer writing stuff, which is amazing. It does not last as long as it should. But during that time, now you also still have to go to a lot of meetings because, you know, there's artists that are building things that you need in your story and there's like programmers making features that you need. And so you've got to keep going to those meetings and sort of maintain, you know, the direction. But you still want to write. I mean, most game writers, I think, in that scenario end up doing most of their writing after like 7 or 8 p.m. And then comes the voiceover process, and all of a sudden you're just out of the studio for months at a time because you're at a voiceover studio in L.A.
Yeah.
And then you're also coming back to the studio, and the sound is cut in, and now you're playing it with the voiceover, so you can hear, you know, like how it's playing, how it's sort of coming off in the game. Depending on where you are in the development process, there's a lot of variation.
I was about to say, yeah, for me, there are some days where I am sitting down at my computer for an entire 8 hours going after string after string after string, you know, checking them for quality and grammar, punctuation, spelling, the whole nine yards. And there's some days where I'm like, my computer, I checked into you in the morning to log in, and thank God I have my email on my phone because I am not at my desk at all. Because I'm checking in with, you know, different teams and seeing, you know, where they're at with their writing, if they're ready to deliver that. I also do VO coordination for my company, so sometimes I'm like, oh God, my hair is on fire, everything is going terribly, oh God, oh my God, I need to gather scripts, are you done? Please tell me you're done. Okay, cool, I'm going to put this in script form, I'm going to send it off here, I'm going to do this thing, I'm going to run around here, I'm going to talk to these five different people, okay, cool. Now I can sit down at my computer and edit strings.
We should have had an editor.
And they are handy.
An editor is kind of like, I lovingly call us, we're ghetto producers. Like, we kind of do a little bit of a production job for the writers, we're producers for the writers, but, you know, it's we do a lot of actual creative work on top of that. It's a weird hybrid job that lends itself to a couple of different disciplines, which is why I think that I do the VO coordination, because it's a weirdly a natural extension. Like when you had an editor also, you had him take over a lot of VO coordination, but you had him go to the sessions.
Yeah, on Reaper of Souls we had an editor on contract, and basically I decided towards, you know, somewhere in the middle of the project that I was going to send him to the voiceover sessions rather than myself, because there was just a lot of stuff going on, and I was kind of like, I kind of need to be in the studio. I can't afford to disappear for 2.5 months, you know? And I figured the editor was the natural person to do that, because I had three writers, and they all, you know, they'd all written various parts of the game, but there were other parts of the game that they weren't that familiar with that someone else had written, right? And the only two people that were familiar with all of the writing in the game were me and the editor, because he had edited every, you know, line of dialogue, every string. So when you're in session and the voice actors have questions about what's going on, what's the context, and you have a, sort of a mental model of how this moment's going to play in game, it's really important that you be very familiar with that part of the game, right? Because you can, you know, even just a slight misunderstanding can lead to completely useless dialogue.
Yeah.
So I sent him up for that, and it was great. It was actually, I mean, There was still writing going on, so he was like, he was basically editing on the fly. Like, he's sitting in the studio, and the actor's about to read a line, and he's like, but I told him, you know, as long as you're familiar enough with the content that you know how to revise the line without changing the content of it, then you have to have that freedom, Because some of those lines were basically had not been edited. I mean, I had seen them, and I had given notes on them, but other than that, they were virgin lines.
Yep. You gotta do in-station changes sometimes.
So at BioWare and Blizzard, do the writers usually go to the VO sessions?
At BioWare, the lead writer usually goes. They don't usually send the normal, you know, everyday workaday writers. Mostly because for them, it's airplane tickets, hotel rooms. Like they have to get someone to that session, they have to spend a fair amount of money. At Blizzard, we just drive up the road, you know. So it's not that big of a deal. BioWare usually sends the lead writer for the same reason that I was just talking about. He or she is the one person that is familiar with the broad sweep of the game. And then at Blizzard, it depends. But yeah, I would sometimes, even when I wasn't sending my editor, I would sometimes send a writer if they were recording something that day that was very particular to that writer, and that writer had strong opinions about it, and they would sort of petition to go, right? And I'd be like, fine.
And switching topics a bit, both you guys work at studios that have fairly large parent companies, or have worked at studios with fairly large parent companies. And this, I'm just curious about, have you ever had those companies give you notes on story or narrative at all? Or like, would they establish like ground rules for what you can and can't do or anything like that?
I think as long as you fall like within your rating, like if you have, say, if you're shooting for a teen rating, you know, you have guidelines to make sure that you stay within a teen rating. But as far as I've known, and I cannot speak with authority on this in the least, I don't believe that HQ has really like said, oh, no, you can't do this. I have never been in those meetings, so I cannot speak to that. Maybe it has come down, and only the level I see, I don't see that, but not to my knowledge.
Yeah, at Blizzard, I don't think I've ever been in one discussion where someone was like, oh, we can't do this thing from an external source, right? I think the team has sometimes very strong opinions. And there will be people, not so much at a parent company, but like, you know, someone who's maybe not on the team, but who's very heavily invested. Like Chris Metzen is the vice president of franchise development, right? So the tone and feel and mood of a particular Blizzard IP is very important to him. So, you know, he'll sometimes want to weigh in on stuff that like, this doesn't feel very StarCrafty, you know, or this feels really StarCrafty. It's a shame it's in Diablo. No. we'll get notes on that kind of stuff, but yeah, I've never even been, I've worked on games that I didn't even know what the ESRB rating was supposed to be. Turns out they were all mature titles, but, but even then, you know, there's a hard M and a soft M or whatever, but they never really bother us with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But on that note, thank you for coming here and talking with us.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, yeah. I have a website, just briankindrigan.com. So just my name plus .com. And I have a blog there where I blog about video game writing stuff. I have that Twitter thing, the Twitters. I'm just at, what am I, at Brian Kindrigan?
You're at Brian Kindrigan.
I don't even know.
You're at Brian Kindrigan,
yeah, I'm at Brian Kindrigan.
If you want to find me, I am at Masana Sadai. My Twitter is not affiliated with anybody, and that is a personal Twitter, and does not reflect the views of my company in the least, or any company I have worked for previously.
Same for me.
And you can find me on Twitter at Twin Made Films.
And I am Max Folkmax on Twitter as well. And you can find the podcast at Script Lock Cast. And that's it. We'll see you next time.